today on Against the Grain. Is meditation a purely private, fundamentally apolitical activity? Not according to Dean Matthewitz, who believes meditation fosters what he calls democratic citizenship and practices of collective liberation. I'm CS, the UC Santa Cruz politics professor, links mindfulness meditation with political engagement, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What does meditation have to do with politics? That question might sound strange because meditative practice seems to be intensely individualistic, inward-looking, private. After all, isn't Buddhist or mindfulness meditation, isn't it about finding a quiet space where we can be alone with our thoughts and observations? Dean Matthewitz believes that meditation has political potential. He's written that meditation is a democratic resource that fosters the deliberation of justice. What makes this possible, according to Matthewitz, is the non-instrumental nature of meditation, the fact that it is not to be done with any goal in mind or for the sake of anything. Dean Matthewitz is an associate professor of politics at University of California, Santa Cruz, and he wrote an article entitled "Meditation is Good for Nothing: Leisure as a Democratic Practice," which appeared recently in the journal New Political Science. When Dean joined me recently in studio, I asked him how long meditation has been a part of Western culture.
Meditation has been a part of Western cultures. I mean, it depends on where you want to go back and set that beginning point of a Western culture. One of the common places that Westerners have done that has been ancient Greece, for example. And we know that the ancient Greeks practiced forms of contemplation and meditation that are not so different than the things that we think of as meditation in sort of the contemporary American context today. In European early modernity and modernity, meditation, different forms of meditation was also a kind of prized practice, the contemplation of nature, sometimes the contemplation of specific texts or symbols. So there's been a range of different kinds of meditative practices throughout this entire span of history that we would think of as connected to Western cultures.
And for how long have Westerners looked to Asian sources for inspiration and guidance in relation to meditation and mindfulness?
There have been periods of sort of, we might call it a Western gaze to the East to think about meditation practices. European philosophers like Kierkegaard and others, Nietzsche, Hegel, looked at different times and in different ways to the East to think about the kinds of cultural practices they saw there in relation to different ways of being or forms of consciousness and so forth. In the American context, in the early 19th century, there was also a period of time when figures like Thoreau and others were looking to the East to think about practices that they would consider contemplative practices, meditative practices, and so forth. And then again in the 1950s, began a wave of attention to Asian meditation practices. And it's that wave of attention is the one that I think is cresting yet again today in cultures throughout North America and the interest in mindfulness meditation, for example.
You note that meditation practices from Asia have had a lot of influence on psychotherapeutic practice.
That's really true. In fact, especially in this most recent wave, starting I think around the 1950s, of interest in North America in meditation, that set of practices really came together with and has been co-developed with psychotherapeutic different kinds of techniques and ways of thinking about how we handle our individual and also our social problems. And so there's a way also that that kind of convergence really has given a distinctive color or flavor to the kinds of mindfulness practices that are being practiced in North America.
And so when I'm reading from your article, there's mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, there's MBSR. What's that?
That's mindfulness-based stress reduction. So that's a form of mindfulness training or teaching that is often practiced in maybe healthcare settings and so forth as an alternative to therapy, also an alternative to psychotropic medication and so forth as a way of helping people cope with stressful situations or habits and so forth.
And is this, does this revolve around kind of relaxation techniques?
Well, MBSR, the mindfulness-based stress reduction, from what I understand, is a process of allowing people to let go of habitual, especially negative patterns of thinking by allowing them to focus on their breath and by allowing them to come back into their bodies. And so that question's a little hard to answer because relaxation sometimes for us means laying back on the couch and getting really cozy, and sometimes it might mean calming your breath, coming back to center. So I think it is a kind of relaxation in the latter sense and not so much in the former sense.
What physical and mental benefits have studies shown accrue to those who do mindfulness meditation?
Well, one of the principal benefits that's talked about is stress reduction. And often that has to do, I think, with the forms of stress that people take on as a result of their habitual stressful patterns of thinking. They also see people who can map the territory of the brain will see changes in the patterns of neurologic activity, the kinds of changes in those patterns of activity that suggest that people become more resilient, that people become more able to not be distracted by unimportant stimuli that's going on around them. This is one important thing about stress reduction is when you can tune out the things that aren't important pieces of information around you. They also see people becoming more empathetic or compassionate with others, more able, that is, I think, to tune in to what is going on with another person and what other people might be feeling or thinking emotionally. Another benefit that is seen is perspective taking, which I think connects to this, which is that it becomes easier to imagine what it might be like to look at a situation from another perspective than your own. So those are some of the many benefits that people who study mindfulness meditation have wanted to draw our attention to in thinking about the practice and some of its potential.
And you're right that perspective taking is supportive of citizenship. And citizenship as a word and a concept comes up a lot in this article. And when you say citizenship, some might think of the formal, the legalistic meaning and notion of that word. That's not the notion you're appealing to, right?
That's right. When I talk about citizenship, and when many political theorists talk about citizenship, rather than that formal legalistic membership, as you mentioned, we are instead thinking about styles and forms of engagement in the world, ways that we engage in our community lives with one another. So we think of citizenship as the kind of identity, if you will, that people have in relation to the political community of which they are a part. That can include being a legal member of that community, but from the perspective that I'm working with and that many political theorists work with, that's more like a backdrop, and sometimes even a backdrop that hinders people from being involved. They may think, oh, well, I've got the membership. I don't need to be involved. Mm. We're interested in the involvement side of this. What it is that draws people in to care about the community, to get engaged with that community, and also to engage with one another as citizens so that I engage with the other people in my community as themselves participants in this community life.
Well, it's interesting you say that because if we come back to meditation, I mean, meditation appears to be a very isolated activity. It is an isolated activity. It appears to be, to many, unpolitical. You know, you're shutting yourself away and doing something very individual-oriented.
Certainly, the way in which the practice is most often performed, that is to go and to sit somewhere, preferably somewhere quiet, by yourself, it has all of that appearance. And in fact, there are ways to practice meditation that would even bolster that feeling in a way, of, especially if you're really wanting to meditate, trying to meditate, you think, I have to get away from all these other people so that I can meditate. One of the things, however, that we're doing when we're sitting is we are discovering how much of a fiction this thing called the separate me is, a fiction that is sort of created and maintained on an everyday basis by the sort of stories we tell ourselves. I'm so irritated by my neighbor who's doing this. I really prefer it when it's like this or like that. And so one of the things that the practice of meditation is encouraging us to relinquish over and over again is some of that story about who the I and the me is that makes me distinct from all of the other people around us. So that's one way in which the practice in itself calls upon us to step aside a little from that image. Another way in which the image of meditation as something intrinsically individual begins to fall away is in relation to some of the benefits that you had just asked me earlier, some of the, we could say, scientifically discussed benefits of meditation, like perspective taking, for example. Even in relation to those more straightforward benefits, we begin to see the ways in which people, by being engaged in the practice, even if they're going off to sit by themselves, the practice fosters in them capacities to overcome some of that individuation when they begin to engage with other people around them.
Dean Mathewitz joins us in studio on Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. He is Associate Professor of Politics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And we are talking about an article he wrote entitled Meditation is Good for Nothing, Leisure as a Democratic Practice, which appeared in the June 2016 issue of the journal New Political Science. And what you're really saying here contrasts sharply with media images of meditation, of people meditating, messages we get from the conventional media about the benefits that accrue to people who meditate. Could you talk about that for a bit?
I think the most common images we get from the media or stories we get from the media about meditation are primarily about being able to disconnect from the things that are going on around us. We get a sense of the overconnectedness of our lives, the overburdened and overbusy quality of our lives. And the image of the meditator is frequently the image of a person who is in some way capable of disconnecting from those things. This, of course, celebrates precisely the individuating component of meditation that you and I were talking about a moment ago as being perhaps the image but not the reality of what the practice entails. And so the idea that meditation is relaxing, that it's about disconnecting, that it's about getting away, those are all things that it speaks more to what people feel is going wrong with their lives. They feel that what's going wrong with their lives is that they're too connected to other people. Instead of being able to perhaps tune into the ways in which we are often saturated with information about the things in our world and saturated even with information about people who are close or not close to us, but information that comes without a kind of connection. And so there's a way in which the media image of meditation is responding to that feeling by presenting meditation to us as an alternative to that saturation of information.
What are we told about the capacity of mindfulness practice to make us better workers, to make us more productive?
Right. So MBSR in particular and other meditation techniques are being picked up in corporate wellness environments and corporate wellness contexts as partly because people don't like their employees to be stressed out, and they see that a stressed out employee, and they may find or learn from different consultants that a stressed out employee is someone who's not living up to the potential that they have to contribute to this particular company. And for this reason, mindfulness and mindfulness-based stress reduction, these approaches have been taken up in the corporate wellness context as a way of helping people to become more productive. We also see seminars and retreats that are being offered and are frequently sold on the basis of the capacity of these practices to help make people more entrepreneurial and more productive. So you might be an entrepreneur of some kind and think that you're going to really be able to get out there in the marketplace and act a lot more effectively if you can master this strategy or technique. And in that way, it becomes very much a kind of self-improvement. I think this is a very visible aspect of present-day meditation cultures, is that they have been drawn in to the larger framework of self-improvement that informs very much the way that Americans and also Westerners more generally think about how to organize their lives.
Contrasting rather sharply with this self-improvement mantra is the American Zen Buddhist tradition, its view toward meditation. How does it encourage us to view meditation?
One of the aspects of the Zen tradition is a special emphasis on what they refer to as the good-for-nothingness of meditation. One thing that a person sitting in the Zen tradition, for example, will very quickly run into is someone enjoining them to sit for no reason, being told that sitting has no purpose, that it doesn't work, and even often with a slight smile, that one should never do it. The idea behind many of these phrases or teachings is to begin dislodging the practitioner away from this image of self-improvement, partly because the image of self-improvement always brings along with it a little bit of subtle aggression against ourselves, as though there's something about us that's not already okay or good enough. So that might be one of the aspects that it is trying to nudge against. But also, or at least from my perspective, it's trying to nudge us against this idea that at every moment, every day, what we need to be doing is to being making something of our time.
Using our time productively.
That's right. Always finding the most productive use for time at any given moment.
So if meditation in this view, according to this view, is not to be done with any goal in mind or for the sake of anything, don't people meditate for a reason in order to make their lives better, to achieve a certain peace of mind, to advance toward what they see as enlightenment?
Certainly. People come to the practice because there are things in their lives that they would like to be different than the way that they are. In the same way that we approach just about everything that we do, we want to have a feeling of efficacy in our lives, that we have some agency to be able to adjust or change the things that are in our world. But one of the, I think, things that the meditation is good for nothing perspective asks us to think alongside that impulse is that in order for us to achieve whatever it is that we want to achieve in the practice, we can't do it for the sake of achieving that thing. Because then our ability to attend to whatever's coming up in the moment that we're sitting, for example, is being already taken away from us by our attention to what it is that we are going to achieve in the future. So if the core of the practice is being able to attend to what's happening now, that can only really happen if you let go of what it is you're hoping or expecting to achieve in the future. So this tension or paradox is really present, I think, in all, or most anyway, traditions or ways of practicing meditation. What I like about the Zen approach in this context is how explicit it is about that paradox and how explicit it is in asking us to bring that forward and to dwell with that paradox as we engage in the practice.
I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Dean Mathewitz is my guest. He teaches in the politics department at UC Santa Cruz. He's author of Appeals to Interest, Language, Contestation, and the Shaping of Political Agency. And one of his current projects explores political theorizing in relation to Zen Buddhism in the U.S., and his particular focus is the Zen emphases on good-for-nothingness and paradox as it speaks to left thinking and practices of citizenship. And interestingly, you turn to, of all people, Aristotle in this paper that we are discussing that appeared in the journal New Political Science, and specifically Aristotle's view of leisure. And maybe before we get into this, could you define leisure as you use the term in this paper?
I define leisure in terms of a particular relation that people have to time. And I like to think about leisure as having a non-instrumental relationship to time. And in that way, we think about leisure time as time in which we are doing what we do, but not for the sake of achieving something else besides whatever the enjoyment or the pleasure or the freedom that we feel in doing what we are doing in that moment.
And where would Aristotle come down on that? Would he agree with you that leisure is almost by definition or inherently non-instrumental, that it is done without an end in mind?
In fact, it's Aristotle who's helped me to think about leisure in this way. So Aristotle, in his way of wanting to think about the different ways that we live our time, especially the time when we are not busy working, for example, wanted to make a very clear distinction between leisure on the one hand, which is, as we've been talking about, non-instrumental, and amusement on the other hand, which for Aristotle was the kinds of activities we do so that we can be ready to go back to work again. And so Aristotle is the thinker who really helped me to begin and to continue thinking about these different ways of inhabiting the time when we are not, strictly speaking, already at work.
So in other words, he thinks amusement is at least partly about preparing us to work, whereas leisure is different. It's not about getting us ready to do anything, getting ready, for example, to go to work the next day.
That's exactly right. And in that way, leisure becomes the way of inhabiting time that one might say habituates us to freedom, habituates us to ways of living and acting and being in the world in which we can actually make choices and think about the various different ways that we would like to live our lives as distinct from the pressures that we face to live our lives or to engage in activity in very particular ways when we are meeting our needs.
And it would be great for your argument if Aristotle made a direct parallel between leisure and meditation, made some kind of connection between the two. Did he?
In the Ethics, Aristotle does talk about contemplation as in some ways the highest example of both leisure and also of ethical activity and ethical attainment. And the discussion of contemplation that he gives, it resembles in many ways the discussion of mindfulness meditation as we might have it in a North American context today. It does have a little bit more perhaps of an intellectual or philosophical bent to it than the way we think of mindfulness meditation today. But he did see those things as very much connected. At the same time, just as he is introducing the discussion of contemplation, of this sort of meditative practice, in his book, The Ethics, he also turns very quickly to practices of citizenship, as though he is recognizing or realizing that in order for us to achieve the things that we would like to achieve in our leisure, in our ethical practice, we need to turn in those moments to think about citizenship as well.
So you have leisure, according to Aristotle, you have contemplation fitting in within this category and maybe being the ideal form of leisure. What does he see leisure and contemplation, how does he see them related to citizenship or encouraging citizenship or maybe even fostering a sense of citizenship within the person doing the contemplation?
So I think in the Ethics, many of the practices that he's describing in the Ethics are ones in which the person is habituating themselves, how they're going to engage with other people. There is a very much a community focus, but the emphasis of the Ethics is on how you are going to live your life. He's talking about the importance of leisure to that. In order to make ethical choices, you have to be able to choose. In order to be able to choose, you have to be in a situation where things aren't already determined for you in advance. All of these things set up a framework in which a leisurely relationship to time is important for individual ethical contemplation. The quick turn that he makes right after introducing contemplation to citizenship and to political life suggests to me his recognition that we actually depend on a context in which we are part of a community in order for any of this ethical cultivation and individual self-fashioning to happen. And so because that larger political community is the inevitable context for this attempt to cultivate ethical personality in oneself, he has to get us to start thinking about what citizenship is going to be like. The end of the book, The Ethics, essentially hands the reader off to his book, The Politics, in which he discusses citizenship. Then, after a long discussion of citizenship, what kinds of different kinds of cities are there that we can live in? How is the city supposed to be organized and so forth? He comes again at the end of the book, at the end of The Politics, to a discussion of leisure. And there we begin to see that one of the things he's very concerned about is that the form of education that is followed in the city is one that enables the citizens to know and to learn how to be at leisure. This gives us a sense that he's returned in some ways to the perspective he was opening up in The Ethics about the importance of leisurely contemplation and so forth. We've now learned that a certain kind of city has to be built up, a certain kind of citizenship has to be practiced in order for there to be leisure. But leisure itself is also the condition in many ways for citizenship. Because in order for people to be able to deliberate in the city, engage in the kinds of citizen activities that have to do with sharing and ruling and being ruled, they have to have that kind of ethical background for themselves, that kind of practice of being able to make choices and to know what it means to live in a context of freedom. So at the same time that citizenship is devoted in some ways to setting up a space in which leisure is possible in the city, leisure is also, in that way, a condition for the exercise of citizenship. We can see these things as mutually supportive, fostering one another.
That's very interesting. Of course, some people would say, well, Aristotle, I mean, do we really want to follow his ideas about citizenship and citizenry? Because did he not exclude a number of people, of categories of people, from citizenship in the legal sense, enslaved people, women, and children, to name a few?
I'm really glad you brought this up because this is one of the things that is most striking to a reader of Aristotle. Aristotle is, of course, writing to the citizens of Athens in his time. And Athens in this time was, although it was an exceptionally inclusive polity and democracy for its time, it was also exclusive in ways that would be completely unacceptable to us today. You've mentioned slaves and women, for example, and you've also mentioned children, which is an exclusion I think that we mostly accept today, but that was also in Aristotle's time. Children, women, and slaves were all excluded. One of the striking things that I have seen in the scholarship around Aristotle in the last decade or so is people beginning to look very closely at the way in which Aristotle talks about and describes these exclusions. And one thing that we find is that Aristotle is writing to an audience, the Athenian audience, for whom those exclusions are an unremarked norm or way of life. And his way of addressing and talking about those exclusions often does so in a way that subtly undermines the taken-for-granted quality of those exclusions. He undermines the taken-for-granted quality of those exclusions, but without ever coming out and saying, and therefore these exclusions are bad and wrong. What then can we make of this? We would like someone who's going to come in and undermine the exclusions in the society to say, and they are bad and wrong. And I think one of the ways that Aristotle scholars have asked us to think about this is Aristotle asking the citizens to begin asking this question for themselves. What should they make of these exclusions in their society? What should they make of the confinement of women to the household? What should they make of their city's dependence on slavery? Because Aristotle is so concerned to engage citizens in a practice of citizenship, which involves a dialogue about the values of the city, Aristotle would be in some ways contradicting that perspective, contradicting the perspective that the citizens need to be engaged in this dialogue about justice, if he came in and said, oh, and by the way, when it comes to these exclusions, I tell you what is just and unjust. And so while Aristotle doesn't fit our standard of someone who should come in and call out as unjust things that appear to us to be obviously and totally unjust, he does open to the citizens of his time the question of justice around some of these exclusions that they took for granted.
Dean Mathewitz, Associate Professor of Politics at UC Santa Cruz, will return after a break and speak more with him about his very interesting research. I'm thinking specifically of an article he wrote entitled "Meditation is Good for Nothing, Leisure as a Democratic Practice." Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Joining me in studio is Dean Mathewitz. It's spelled M-A-T-H-I-O-W-E-T-Z. He teaches politics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And we are talking about an article he wrote about the degree to which meditation, mindfulness meditation practice, might actually foster and support practices of collective liberation and help make possible the creation of democratic citizens. So, Dean, you mentioned that Aristotle saw leisure as the objective, in fact, the primary objective of education. Can you elaborate on that and also tell us what kind of education he saw as most suitable for developing students' capacities for leisure?
So one way into this very interesting question is to step back very briefly and say, and to note that the word for leisure in Greek is skole. It's spelled S-C-H-O-L-E. And that is the word from which our word school comes from. And so this connection between education and leisure in Aristotle is one that is still with us in our own image of the school, in our own word of the school. It also is with us in the idea of a liberal education. The term liberal in liberal education is to refer to the idea of liberty, that is, to freedom. And so the idea that Aristotle is developing about the relationship between skole, that is, leisure, an education or a education that makes you free, these are very much with us today in these images of education as something that frees people by putting at their disposal, we might say, a range of possibilities. And the wider the range of possibilities are that people have, the more we say they would have the capacity for experiencing and or acting out the possibilities of freedom in their lives. And so for Aristotle, this involved people learning different kinds of practices that would enable them to inhabit time, to inhabit the space of their lives, the time of their lives, in ways that spoke to the possibilities of freedom in it. And that is the way in which we can think about Aristotle wanting leisure, that is, this non-instrumental relationship to our time, to be the central focus of education. We have, in some ways, I think, very much lost this image today, but it's still with us in our language of liberal arts education and of the school. Now, for Aristotle, who surveys the different forms of education that are being practiced in Athens at his time, is most interested in music education. He sees music education as the one that will most enable people to learn this practice of being at leisure. Partly this is because he understands that practicing and engaging in music is the kind of thing that people do because it's a pleasure in itself. It is simply pleasurable and simply enjoyable to be engaged in music and to have a direct relationship to music in this way, in music performance. And so Aristotle settles in on music education, and he's especially from there wants to talk about the different kinds of ethical qualities, like courage, for example, that teaching people the right kind of music could raise up in them.
So let's return to meditation and mindfulness meditation. So you just told me that, according to Aristotle, leisure is a kind of condition of citizenship. You write that it's the environment in which citizenship can happen, in which practices of citizenship can flourish. So can you sum up what we can take, what you have taken from Aristotle that applies to meditation as a non-instrumental practice, as you were mentioning earlier?
Right. So just as Aristotle looks around and sees music out there as a practice that he can light onto, as something that has potential in it for citizen education, I see something very similar in meditation today. And part of what especially interests me about meditation is that although we might come to it because we feel like we're suffering or we're stressed out or whatever, just like people might come to music because they like the pretty sound and the good things that it makes them feel, there's also something else going on in there, right? Something that goes beyond that immediate draw to us. And in the case of meditation, it's precisely the way in which meditation enjoins us to do nothing for that period of time. That being present with the present moment, learning how to tune in to that present moment, learning how to drop some of the narratives and stories that we bring with us into the present moment, all of these things ask us to let go of the idea that we are doing or achieving anything in particular in that period of time. I think that because this idea is so especially difficult for us as modern, you know, people living in North America today, people living under capitalist conditions, this idea is so difficult for us. I think that's what makes meditation especially powerful. In a period of time in which we are always made to feel, we have this phrase, wasting time. And one of the things we're often made to do is to feel that we've done something wrong if any time has been wasted. We need a new relationship to time. And having a new relationship to time, one that is about not doing anything or achieving anything, can begin helping us to perceive or to feel a little bit of that practice of freedom, a little bit of that condition of freedom in a context in which, especially in relation to time, we almost never have a feeling or a practice of freedom. So much of our relationship to time is a practice of allocation, always putting it toward something, spending it in a certain particular kind of way. And so I think under these conditions of capitalism today and the way that people have to work and so forth, inhabiting a practice that encourages us to approach and to live in time in a radically different way, I think has a lot of potential. And it has an important potential, especially if we want to think about what it means to be free in relation to and in a context marked by the imperative always to be productive, always to accumulate, always to spend wisely, and never to waste.
Freedom, however, means different things to different people. So freedom, in a very libertarian sense, politically libertarian sense, could be individual freedom, freedom to be left alone. So in what sense might the freedom generated, or the feeling of freedom generated by mindfulness meditation, in what way might that feed into a sense of a collective project, a collective liberation, a desire maybe to act together with other people in a way that changes one society?
Some of this goes back to some of the benefits of mindfulness meditation that we talked about a little bit earlier, including perspective taking, for example. So, and also the way in which a meditation practice becomes a practice of relinquishing or letting go of some of those attachments by which we define our most individualized or most narrowly conceived self. So from within that perspective, there is very much, there is already within that perspective a little bit of this push away from a hyper-individualized and toward a more connected picture of how we can act and engage with one another. In another way, part of this concern that you've raised, that meditation could be individualizing or could be atomizing of people, in another way that may come to us or come up for us partly due to the secularization of mindfulness cultures. Because that framework for meditation automatically or already teaches us to think about meditation as primarily an individualized intervention to deal with some of the different problems that we have today. So meditation, I'm tempted to say meditation in itself isn't necessarily going to automatically connect us. So I'm tempted to say that despite some of these benefits that I just mentioned a moment ago, some of our approach to meditation might nonetheless want to pull us into a direction of individualization if we approach meditation primarily as an individual kind of therapy. This is why I think an important part of meditation practices is the connection that these practices have to the wisdom traditions and therefore the processes of adaptation of those wisdom traditions into a present-day context. And so to the extent that we are concerned about the individualizing potential in or atomizing potential in mindfulness, I think it's worthwhile for us to think about those larger wisdom traditions from within which meditation has come to us and see that they might actually in some ways be more important to the practice than the most secularized versions of mindfulness might ask us to recognize.
And maybe it's appropriate here to bring up the Heart Sutra, which is a Buddhist text which addresses the question of whether things have independent existence.
Exactly. This is one of the other dimensions of the mindfulness is good for nothing slogan that I mentioned earlier in relation to the non-instrumental dimension of practice. Because the nothing that is referred to in that phrase fits with this teaching from the Heart Sutra about nothingness. The term in that sutra is shunyata. And the nothingness that is being referred to there is specifically the way in which nothing in the world is independent of other things. All the things in the world are connected to one another. You can think of this in a very scientific framework today and just think that every single thing has at least a little bit of its cause, all of the other things that are around it. And in that way, everything is in some tiny way causally related to the other things around us. They always form a part of the condition or the context for the appearance of some other thing. In the Buddhist tradition, they'll sometimes say that all things are free of independent existence. So there's another one of the image of freedom there, is an image of freedom from being independent, right? Freedom to see and to acknowledge and to play with and to be cognizant of those dependent connections that things have on one another. And so when we think about meditation as being good for nothing, it's both good for nothing in the sense that it is non-instrumental. It's also good for nothing in the sense that it helps us to realize that teaching in our everyday lives, to realize the interconnectedness of things. And so to the extent that mindfulness practice puts that interconnectedness within our reach, it becomes automatically a kind of de-individualizing practice.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Dean Matthewitz is my guest. He is Associate Professor of Politics at the University of California, Santa Cruz. And he is involved in a kind of project that theorizes Zen Buddhism in the U.S. in relation to politics and democratic practice and citizenship. And I was drawn to his work in the journal New Political Science. In the June 2016 issue, you'll find an article he wrote entitled "Meditation is Good for Nothing, Leisure as a Democratic Practice." Another argument you make, and you make this actually more in a separate piece, but you touch on it in this article, is that there is something paradoxical about meditation. And I think you've kind of already addressed that, that helps us understand or adapt to or deal with the paradox of the political world, that the political world is inherently paradoxical. In what sense?
The political world is a complex space. When we are engaging in politics, we are inevitably engaging in complex issues in which there are many perspectives, in which things have many different sources of causation. And so I like to think of the political world as being a complex and heterogeneous space. And due to that complexity, it's probably very often appropriate for us to feel ambivalent about our engagement in that political world, to sometimes feel frustrated by the ambiguity that all of this complexity presents to us. At the same time, the political world and the problems that come up for us in politics are of such a nature that action has to be taken and something has to be done. And I understand these two different things, the complexity and heterogeneity and ambivalence and ambiguity of the political world, and the fact that we have to take a side and to do something, as being a constitutive paradox of the political world and political action today. We need to be able to hold both of those things at the same time. If we let go of the side of it, that is, that we need to take action and do something, we could become paralyzed by how complex the issues are and by the ambiguities and ambivalence in them and say, well, I can't really do anything because anything I do will be harmful in some way. If we let go of the complexity and heterogeneity part and just decide, well, something has to be done, gosh darn it, no matter what, then we can become ideologues who cease to see the other perspectives, who don't see the complexity. And so I often think of the political world as having this constitutive paradox at its heart, and that in order for us to really engage in political thinking and action, we need to hold both of these two contradictory ideas alongside of each other all of the time. It seems to me that that paradox has a really important parallel, or a really useful parallel, in the Buddhist practice of sitting, and especially in the good-for-nothingness of the practice. Because on the one hand, as I've said, the practice is something that one has to do without the sake of reaching any particular end. One has to be able to sit with the complexity and ambiguity of one's situation and not be able to hope that one can achieve any particular thing by engaging in the practice. On the other hand, we do sit in order that we might have that feeling of efficacy in our lives. Both of those things, just as they are true for the Buddhist practice of sitting, so too, they have a parallel in the condition of the political world. And so I think there's a way in which practicing on an intimate scale, sitting for no reason, sitting as good for nothing, can help us to engage on the collective scale with this constitutive paradox of the political world.
So, Dean, we've been talking a lot about kind of individual, personal consciousness, right? And as cultivated by, as fostered by meditation and its relationship to the political and the benefits it can have in terms of supporting political action. And a lot of radical thinkers, and of course Marx comes up quite a bit in this context, is, you know, it's the structures of society, it's the structural and systemic roots of things like exploitation that need to be recognized and then addressed. So to what extent is your research and the insights you've shared with us today kind of pushing back against the emphasis on structure to the perhaps exclusion of one's own kind of emotional and spiritual transformation?
So it is, of course, a profoundly important thing to recognize, which is the shape of the structures that emerge out of all of the individual actions that we are all taking every day. Being able to see the shapes of those structures and also to see within them the different intervention points that there might be for us to engage in social transformation, for example. At the same time, it's important for us always to bear in mind that the distinction between structural problems and structural formations and individual action, that that's a little bit of a false dichotomy for us. Because after all, the structure and what the structure is the outcome of all of the individualized actions that we are taking every day. At the same time that we take individualized actions within a context that is created by the structure. So that these two things, rather than really being in opposition to one another, each of them is a kind of particular lens that we shine on one complex phenomenon, which is the way in which individual actions add up to patterns. There has been, of course, in a lot of academic work and a lot of social theorizing, an emphasis on structures, as you point out, because of the importance that they have in helping us to have this overview. But they can also leave us with something, something that Ken Jones writes about in his book, The New Social Face of Buddhism, as the social fallacy. That is, that we begin to focus on those structures and think about structural interventions at the expense of also thinking about the individualized or more local patterns of which they are a part. And so in this way, we have to think about how to cultivate intimate practices and intimate ways of being alongside our interest in social transformation, to see that those two things always have to come together, but that the kinds of interventions and the kinds of practices that will address both the more intimate or the more global scale might also be different in this way. So certain kinds of political action will address the structural issues, and other kinds of ethical self-fashioning or other kinds of intimate practices like mindfulness have an important role to play at the more intimate scale.
Dean Matthewitz is his name, spelled again M-A-T-H-I-O-W-E-T-Z, Associate Professor of Politics at UC Santa Cruz. He's author of Appeals to Interest, Language Contestation and the Shaping of Political Agency. And we've put a link on our website, againstthegrain.org, to the article in the journal New Political Science that we've been discussing today. It's an article by Dean entitled Meditation is Good for Nothing, Leisure as a Democratic Practice. Dean, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And New Political Science is the journal of the Caucus for a New Political Science, which was founded in 1967 to make the study of politics relevant to the struggle for a better world. The caucus is organized around the position that a commitment to social justice, a sustainable democratic society, and human rights is central to the study of politics. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.